Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today on The Stacks Book Club, we're discussing perennial New York Times bestseller, Educated by Tara Westover. We brought back Sarah Ennie, who is the wonderful author of Tell Me Everything and the host of First Draft Podcast with Sarah Ennie, and she's going to help us break down this book. Please be warned, there are spoilers on today's episode. Before we dive in, I just wanted to remind you, in the show notes, there is a link. In that link, it will take you to all the books, articles, movies, whatever else we discussed today. If you use that link to shop on Amazon, you'll help keep the stacks free. So it's a win-win for everyone. Okay, great news. Our friends over at the Lady Gang have just put their newest Lady Box on sale, and they've asked me to tell you guys a little bit about it because it's kind of amazing and a fantastic deal. So it has over $250 worth of beauty and lifestyle goodies in this box. It features fragrances from Kai Fragrance, hair products from Playa, and skin solutions from Shiffa Beauty, plus a lot more. So head over to theladygang.com to find out more information and order soon because they will sell out. If you love this show and want to help us grow and take on new exciting projects, check out our Patreon page. You earn perks like our virtual book club, and you get to know you're supporting a podcast you love. Head to patreon.com/thestacks. Supporting our sponsors helps support the show, so make sure you check out Audible for all your audiobook needs. If you're new to Audible, you'll get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download just for listening to The Stacks. So head to audibletrial.com/thestacks. And then the last thing I have to tell you, which is what I always tell you, is please subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast wherever you're listening. It's super easy and it really helps The Stacks. So if you have a moment, please, please, please rate and review this podcast. Okay, let's get into this conversation of Educated by Tara Westover with our guest, Sarah Ennie. All right, you guys, we're back today with Sarah Ennie. Sarah is an author, journalist, and podcast host. Her new book is called Tell Me Everything. And today for the Stacks Book Club, she and I are talking about a very small book that you've probably never heard of. It's called Educated. It's by Tara Westover. It's never been on any lists ever. It's not a bestseller. I think like seven people have read it.
It really snuck under the radar.
Yeah, no one's heard of it. It's like not even Michelle Obama's book is anywhere near it now.
I will say I did a little bit. I was like, I want to know a little bit more about her. And then I was like watching an interview with her and Bill Gates. And I was like, all right, I don't need
to. She's also our age, you know that.
Yes,
it's like,
I can't
it's like
handle
born
it.
In 1986. I was like, oh.
I can't handle
I
it.
I just assumed she was 45, and I was like, I'm doing fine. I still have like 15 years to get there. Nope. So Educated, it's her memoir. For those of you who have not yet read the book, we are going to spoil it. We both read it, so we're going to talk about it. If you haven't read it and you care, turn this off. Come back when you're finished. If you haven't read it and you don't care, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
And if you have read it, let's get going.
Yes.
Okay, so where we always start, what did you think of the book?
I mean, overall, I really enjoyed it. It's kind of an odd thing. It ended up being really intense.
Yeah.
I don't know what I expected, but I mean, I rarely feel like a reading of book was a waste of time. I rarely
feel that.
Yeah.
Though I have felt it in my life. That I'm like, I can't believe I'm reading this book. Yeah. Usually for the show.
Oh, interesting.
Like where I'm like, I have this person coming in, I have to read their book, and I'm like, this is a waste of my time.
Yeah.
No, I don't feel like this was a waste of time.
It was really beautifully written.
Yeah.
That is for sure. I really came away being, and I was listening to it on audiobook, which is new for me. I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah.
And the audio, I thought that the reader was fantastic. I thought she did a great job. I think it's won awards and it deserved them. But so for me, it was like, eating ramen and walking around my neighborhood listening to this like really intense and frequently upsetting personal story.
Yeah. So a friend of mine also listened to it and she was like, I can't wait to hear what you think. I can't wait to hear it. And I was like, I hope I like it. She was like it. You're going to love it. And I was like, okay. And so I text her when I finished yesterday and I was like, don't hate me. I liked it. I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And she was like, maybe it's because you didn't listen on the audio. And I'm like, maybe. But I think from what I understand, the audio is really good because the narrator like really – like some of the more dramatic scenes, she really like draws it out and you're kind of like, what's going to happen?
Yes.
And I don't know. I didn't really have the what's going to happen feeling as much reading it. I thought the writing was good. I have to say, I just thought the book was good. I thought it was a really solid book. I did not really actually care about Tara Westover.
I totally agree with that. I was, and like, to me, and this is what I'm like dying to get into with you, now that I've finished the book, looking back, it's less about what I expected it to be about, which is I really kind of just thought she was going to talk about her education and like the difference in like being not homeschooled versus like the rigors of Cambridge where she ended up and stuff like that. And that was, that actually was so backseated. So I was sort of like, oh, I'm on this whole other ride. And then at the end, looking back, now I'm like, she really didn't grapple with a lot of
her stuff.
Her stuff. I was like, so you, to be clear, Tara Westover was raised with survivalist Mormons who were misogynistic, racist abusers.
Right.
And like, she really doesn't say it flat out ever.
She doesn't say it. And I think that that is probably the biggest problem with the book is that she presents a lot of stuff. And for me, so two things. One is that I just read this book in August 2019. So this book has been out for a year and a half. Probably everyone else listening right now read this book somewhere between February 2018 when it came out and the end of last year.
Right.
Like, I think that I'm like, people were shocked that I'd never read it.
It's so,
I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
But the other part is that one of my personal reading wheelhouses is cults, fundamental religions. That's my jam.
Oh my God. I need to have a whole email thread about this because I'm obsessed.
So for me, I was like, I'm not shocked by any of this. I actually know all of this. And I actually think your childhood could have been a lot worse considering the stories I've read about other Mormon people. Like, and not all Mormon people, fundamentalist Mormons and like these specific groups and these specific families in Idaho.
Yeah,
like, Idaho is a scary place.
Yeah.
Want to talk about Oklahoma City bombing. Want to talk about Waco. Want to talk about Randy Weaver. Like, there's a lot of crazy shit that goes down in Idaho, not all Idaho. Let me just preface this whole conversation. This is not all anyone or anything or anywhere.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about things. I just don't want people to be like, I'm Mormon and that's not my experience. I'm not saying that
at all. It's not about that.
But in the reading that I've done about fundamental like Christianity, religions, about cult, about these families, like I felt like it was kind of tame.
Yes.
And which is crazy to say because her shit was totally fucked up.
It
but like
was wild.
Yeah.
But she really, it like, so for example, like the reason that you're talking about cults and stuff, I feel like this is so funny. I'm going to just go forward assuming that everyone listening to this has read it.
Yeah. If not, I can't cater to you.
The fact that I did have a suspenseful experience because of the audiobook. I do think that's a really apt point your friend made because I was like, what's going to happen? You know, I had no sense of where I was in the book. You know, it's like this audiobook is new for me and I really enjoyed this experience because it was really different. But the fact that they let some of the kids go
was so weird.
Right. And I was like, oh, you know, I mean, that made me happy because like she got to escape that. I mean, like the fact that they were never, or she never talks about, like, she was physically abused. We don't have, she never talks about any kind of like sexual assault.
Right.
But I don't, I mean, it was, yeah, I feel like there's a lot that's unsaid.
I do. I feel like there's a lot that's unsaid. I feel like what's interesting about the book and the fact that it's gotten so popular is that it is relatively tame for what it is. And I think maybe because I've discovered from doing this podcast and just in general from the way that I read that a lot of people don't read as intensely as I do. And so I think that like a lot of books that I love are too uncomfortable for people. So I wonder if this book, because it is uncomfortable and there is a lot of abuse and there is crazy stuff, but she's not really asking you as the reader to examine how terrible things can get, that maybe it's like more approachable. And I don't mean that in like a, like I recognize that my reading is very intense for a lot of people. So I think that like this might be a more approachable or like digestible version. But for people who are used to reading like these crazy stories or who go deep dive on those like documentaries and stuff like I do, this felt like, I don't know. And I think it is, I think what you're saying about like her family was all of these things and she doesn't really grapple with it. Like her brother calling her the N-word and her being like, But Sean wasn't racist. He just like didn't really know better. Or like right. maybe he just we only knew one black person. It's kind of like, okay. But he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Like it's not.
And she brings that up in the same context within explaining that at first he called her a whore for a long time.
Right. And like that was, quote, her word. Like right. when the other, I think Emily, the other girlfriend said that he used to call her a whore, she was like, that was my word.
Right.
Like that there was.
So he was cycling through all these words, trying to see what was going to get to her. So he knew that that word had context. He knew
right.
that the N-word was a terrible thing to call someone. That's why he was doing
right,
it.
Right, exactly. And like maybe he didn't know the history of the civil rights movement, but he knew what the N-word meant. Because yeah. he said, I'm calling you that because you're black, like you're covered in black.
Right.
So he didn't just hear it like, oh, that's like calling someone an asshole. Like
yes.
he knew. And she doesn't grapple with like, her whiteness. And like, that's part of it too, is the thing. It's like, okay, so if you're going to say that he didn't know because you guys don't know any black people, then talk about literally not knowing any black people.
Yeah. Or having it introduced. And then it's so, I mean, I think that you and I both kind of then had a moment at this exact point in the book. Cause then it was like all that she had learned about slavery growing up was her dad talking about how actually slaves had it better than their owners because they didn't have, it was like this
yeah.
really twisted logic. And I was like, so what you're not addressing is that you did know about it and you learned about it in a blatantly racist context.
Right.
Same with then she has this like really intense story about being a freshman at BYU and asking an art history teacher what the word Holocaust meant.
Right.
And I mean, she doesn't not present that as an awful thing.
Right.
But I was like, well, then up to that point, up to the discussion of the N-word and slavery and the discussion of the fact that she didn't know what the Holocaust was, she hadn't given us a sense of what her family, what she was learning from her family.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Like she talks about her like going through the book and like putting her finger down the page and saying she was like doing school or whatever. But she doesn't really talk about what was taught. Like her yeah. mother really didn't teach her anything. Like how was she taught to read?
Right.
What was that like? And maybe she doesn't remember and I don't know, but the Holocaust, I mean, that Holocaust story is wild. Could you like, I thought yeah. a lot about myself in that context. Cause like I'm such an intense personality and like, I love to not give people the benefit of the doubt a lot of the time. Like, especially right now, especially like the way that the country is right now, like mm-hmm. it's really hard. And I was thinking, like, what would I do if I was in a class and someone said, I don't know that word? Like, excuse me?
Right.
Like, what are you doing here? She went to BYU. Like, that's a real major school. That's not like, I mean, that's not like some teeny tiny college like that no one's ever heard of. Like, some major, major college. So I can't imagine being in that room. And like, it really makes you. One of the things that this book really made me think about was what is education mm-hmm. and what is the education system and what are things that we are expected to know and what are things that we are expected to learn?
Right.
And
yeah,
I don't know.
Right. It made me think about that too, because I was like, you know, it did make me think about the reason we value education the way we do or the way we've structured it is so that as a human in America in 2019, we all are assumed to have certain shared reference points.
Right.
Right. I think we can all agree that like education has a long way to go. And especially right. If you're being educated in our public schools, like there's a lot of room for improvement. And you know, I mean, I knew almost nothing about beyond European history when I came out of school. And that was like devastating to realize.
Right.
I mean, whatever. That's a whole other conversation. But she had no touchstones.
Right.
And no shared understanding. She didn't know what a textbook was or that she should read it. So it was like, it was devastating to think about her obviously being this really smart person, being right. in a situation where she's so hobbled by the fact that no one even attempted to cultivate her brain at all. Right. But I can't get away from this point that we're both kind of expressing similarly, which is, in writing this book, and I think you're right that this is what makes it more approachable, but in writing this book, I wish she was more honest about this stuff. She obviously came out of her upbringing feeling probably, I mean, she was obviously like consumed with internalized misogyny.
Right.
Which she does deal with.
Right.
But she was obviously raised by a racist family.
Right.
By a family with racist beliefs. And also like the fundamentalist Christian beliefs are terrible in a lot of other ways.
Right.
And she sort of, it was dealt with in this really odd backwards feeling
right.
way.
Like there were some things she was okay with talking about, like being like the anti-government stuff. She was
right.
okay with talking about like being okay with getting a grant and like,
right.
like there were certain
and medicine.
Yeah.
A lot of dealing with
like that stuff she was okay with talking about. And it was interesting that she chose not to, like, I can't remember what this came from, and it might be from Missoula by John Krakauer, which is not BYU, but it's in Montana. It's mostly white kids, but the black kids who go there are the athletes.
Mm.
And I was really curious about her experience. If she only met one black girl who was adopted, then going to BYU, where a lot of the black kids who go there are athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And like they're revered as being athletes. Like, what was that like for her? Like being around black people for the first time.
Right.
You know, and like I think BYU has like a pretty decent Asian population also. So like what was that like?
Mm-hmm.
Like if she's never been around people and she's been on this mountain, what was it like? She talks about being around Gentiles or like non-Mormons, but she doesn't talk about her first encounter with a black man.
Right.
And like, did that bring up something for her? Did that
right.
freak her out? Had she been taught to fear them? Or did she not? Was she with a friend who got weird around a black guy and she was like, why are you being weird? Because that would be interesting too.
Right. There's a lot that goes unaddressed. You know, and then later when she is at Cambridge and she goes to travel to Italy with her friends, you know, I found that to be a really beautifully written passage, but it was also odd and as you said, she is like 32 or something,
right.
which is,
right.
you know, alarming
right.
because she's so accomplished and this
right.
book is so well written. That's what we mean by that. She's an incredibly impressive person. But I was also like, I wonder if she obviously wrote, this is like the story of her life and she's 32. There's a lot she's still working through.
I think that too,
and
for sure.
I was like, I'm excited in 30 years to read your next memoir where
right.
maybe you'll be more ready to process
right.
because she's... I think we all are tasked to do this as adults, but her experience of this is way more extreme, is you have to unlearn
right.
a lot of what you learned as a kid,
right.
regardless of how you're raised.
Right.
Even happy childhoods end up being like, well, what are the habits you got?
Right.
You know, what are the ways of thinking that you need to expand your worldview to be in the world as an older person? And she is still in that process very much. And so I think what you and I are noting is that from a book standpoint, there was a lot that wasn't addressed in here that we would have been fascinated
right,
to
really
hear more about.
To hear more about.
Yeah.
And yeah, thinking about her future, I really would read the memoir of this book tour.
Ooh, I would too.
Like, because there's no way she could have thought this book was going to be this book.
And she's talking about the rupture of her family. She doesn't talk
right.
to her family anymore.
Right.
So now she has this book that is...
Like, I want to know who reached out to her, if anybody did from
right.
her family. I want to know what it was like for her going to cities that were so different than Salt Lake City or Cambridge. Like, Cambridge is a pretty white place, too.
Very
like,
white.
Harvard is a pretty white place, too. And, like, so I'm curious, like, when she took this book to, I don't know, like, even, like, San Francisco, which is very white, but, like, very obsessed with diversity and, like,
right.
very obsessed with that idea
right.
of education and diversity versus, like, if she took it to Dallas, like, what was that like? And when she went back to Salt Lake City, which I'm sure she did. Like,
positive.
I'm curious to know. And I'm sure this book took her around the world and she got to meet insane people and like Barack Obama read her book. So I just like that would be the book that I would love to read. Like things I learned on tour.
Yeah.
Like by Tara Westover or
Dude,
whatever.
I would too. I really would love that. And also to hear her talk about, I don't know because I haven't done a lot of research into how this book was received or what conversations have been had as a result
right.
of this book, but I can imagine there's a lot of conversation around Mormonism generally.
Yeah.
And as you and I both said, like, she's really clear in the book at the very beginning about this is not about Mormonism,
right.
this is not whatever. But I can imagine that some people have taken it that way
yeah.
and addressed questions
yes.
with that context.
Yes.
And I bet that was upsetting for her.
Right.
You know, she's really clear about not wanting this to be an anti-Mormon book, and it's not because people like us are familiar with the fact that it's about cult leaders,
yeah.
really,
and like
fundamentalists.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is such a popular book that I'm sure some people are taking it the way she's not intending it.
Right. And I'm sure people who are Mormon feel like that it is attacking
right.
them as well, which I'm sure is not her intent. I'm also curious, like, what religious things she still has or right. doesn't have. Like, does right. she still go to church at all? Does she still talk to any bishops? Like, how has writing this book changed her relationship to religion? I think yeah. really what I guess we're both kind of getting at is, like, we need the sequel that's Tara talking about the book.
Yes.
Or something, like, talking – I just felt like there were things she didn't talk about that were the things that I wanted to hear about.
Yeah.
And, like, while I feel like the abuse stuff, like, she's very open with, I kind of was like, okay, I got it.
Right.
Like, you could have used – and, I, like, one of the things I said is, like, the book could have been shorter. Mm-hmm. It actually didn't need to be shorter. It just could have been about more things or different things. Like, it could have been a different use of 350 pages.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And, like, there was – not that it was – you know, obviously – it seems like in the process of writing this book, she was really grappling with the abuse. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, first of all, then not to be, like, a voyeuristic about it, like, I would have loved to read more about how her own relationship to sex did evolve.
Yeah.
Because obviously she was in a series of long-term relationships.
Right.
And at first she does talk about how it was difficult to be romantically, physically intimate with, even just kissing with right. her first boyfriend, because her brother had physically assaulted her so right. much. And she doesn't talk about it, but I'm sure her dad, I'm sure hitting was happening in that house.
Yeah. And also just, like, the idea of modesty.
Right.
Like, that was so huge.
Overpowering, you yeah. know? It doesn't sound like she wore anything form-fitting until she was
on this book tour.
Literally on this book tour. Yeah, exactly. So it does feel like we got a lot of extended graphic portrayals of the abuse she suffered at the hand mm-hmm. specifically of her brother. And we do grapple with how he and her dad are, like, I mean, I was fascinated by the portrayal of manipulators, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, literal cult leader level of right. emotional manipulation and on purpose, and how, you know, I think there's been a cultural conversation lately about grooming and how these two abusers really set the stage to, you know, and she had this, like, the story progresses to the point where she really, truly, all Tara is asking is for her family to acknowledge
right.
that she was physically abused by her brother, and they can't do that.
Right.
They gaslight her.
Right.
And she is presented with a choice, either deny the experience of your life that you have had
right.
or lose your family. And the end of the book is she chooses to trust herself and to lose right. her family. And so that was really moving. And I was like, I'm here for that ride. But if that was the sole purpose, I agree, we could have shed 100 pages.
Yeah.
Or really gotten into more stuff.
Yeah, I was more into her education. Mm. Not necessarily her academic education, mm-hmm. but her education, like, her educating herself on these things and
human.
These people and these experiences. And, like,
she was sort of a Martian.
Yeah, like she talks about her roommate who was like, and we all need to wash our hands with soap. Like, and I'm like, I want more of those stories.
Yeah.
Like, I want more of the stuff where you're like, right. I did not know to use soap because I didn't pee on my hands because that's what my dad said.
Right.
Like, stuff like that was, like, really – those, like – and that's kind of, like, the same thing as the Holocaust thing. It's, like, these little moments where you see her and what she really is lacking. Because
right.
she is so smart and the book is well written and we know that she goes on to get a PhD, it's kind of hard to believe that she ever didn't know things. Mm-hmm. And so I think her saying, I didn't know this thing, was really illuminating and helpful for me as a reader and connected me to her.
Agreed. And also, yeah. like, there – I could have used a little bit more about – what she was writing in some ways I got whiffs of, and this may be unfair, so whatever, but I got whiffs of the feeling I had with Rory Gilmore and The Marvelous Miss Maisel, where I was
like, I don't watch that.
Well, I'm not here to recommend it because
okay.
I'm about to tell you what annoys me about that.
Oh, okay.
But she, we hear throughout the book, you know, that she needed to get a certain score on a test to get into BYU. Mm-hmm. And she, like, exceeds the score.
Right.
Then she doesn't know what the Holocaust is, but manages to learn how to read a textbook, and then she gets all A's and gets
right.
these scholarships. So it's very clear to us that she's smart, but I could have used more about, like, what were you writing about?
Mm-hmm.
What were you – I wanted so much more granularity to, like, how did you form your ideas? You
like, were, how did this happen?
Yeah. What was your dissertation about? Like she kind of goes into it, but I just wanted – I wanted to have a better understanding of how she went from having zero academic even concept
mm-hmm.
to being so great that her professor pleaded the case that it was a gross injustice not to let her go to Cambridge. You know, like we're told these. And the Rory Gilmore thing is that Rory Gilmore throughout the Gilmore Girls were told that she's so brilliant and so smart and such a great journalist. And I'm like, I never see you do great journalism. Like I never see you. I don't believe it. Because I'm not seeing that reflected to me.
Right.
And that's – I lacked
– That's so interesting. A bit of
it. Like I literally would have read her dissertation if they put it in the back just to be like, what were your thoughts?
What were you thinking?
What made you so – because clearly you are – and now you have this book that's been on the bestseller list for 2 years. Like you are an extraordinary person. But I sort of just I'm still not able to put my arms all the way around it for some reason.
Okay, we're going to – I want to leave this book quickly, kind of. There are other books to me that are like this, that are like really popular. People like love them, are obsessed with them, do really well. And then I read them and I'm like, I don't get it.
Mm.
And I'm so curious what that is.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has that. Yeah. Like it might not be Educated for You. It might be Gone Girl. It might be – I don't know.
Well, we talked about A Little Life last week.
A Little Life. Well, I was going to say this also is reminding me of our conversation about A Little Life. But there are books. But A Little Life was not as big as this. Like, I'm thinking, like, I don't know, Malcolm Gladwell. I'm thinking, like, Michelle Obama's book. These books that are, like, monsters. Little Fires Everywhere.
Mm.
Like, there are these books that are monsters that have been on the bestseller list for years or weeks or whatever. And they connect with 90% of the population. And then there's the 10%. For me, Educated is I'm in that 10%. But like for, you know, Malcolm Gladwell, I'm in the 90%.
Right.
So like I don't – it's not necessarily all about the particular reader. I just am so curious like how a book like this gets picked up and becomes this versus something like even like The Glass Castle, which is essentially this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was popular, but it wasn't this.
Right.
So I just – I'm so curious like what it is that people feel about this book and this abuse and this success and this education that is more important or enjoyable than The Glass Castle or whatever.
Well, here is where I'm going to push back on this as a theory from the standpoint of being a published author.
Okay.
I want to be careful that we don't mistake meritocracy for marketing.
Right.
So, because that's what I would say. I would say like a book like this, sometimes – what happens with books is like The Glass Castle is actually a great example. Like why isn't that so massive? I mean, it was huge, but not like this.
It was like people talk about it. People know it. It's withstood the test of time.
Right.
But I don't feel like it was Educated when it came out.
Right. And I think it's just like one, it's an accumulated thing. It's a snowball rolling down the mountain. You know, it just, becomes this thing, and then at some point it's not even, and at some point it becomes like so big that you can't even say you didn't like it, and then that just keeps, it becomes a monster, you know.
Right.
And what we're talking about is zeitgeist, right? Like, how do you define that? How do you, what is it that falls into that? What doesn't? I mean, that is really confusing sometimes, and also like fascinating,
Because we never have taken on a book on this show quite as popular as this.
Here's the other thing that is really funny to me about this is that in my perspective, it's funny to hear you frame it that way because I don't think about the book that way.
What do you think about it as?
It definitely was huge and I heard about it a ton, but not as much as others. And I'm in like the YA sphere. So what I think that we sort of like just had different.
Right. But it's still like third or first on New York Times bestseller this week.
Yeah.
I just saw it. It's like this. It's Gia Talenti's new book and it's Michelle Obama's book still.
Wow.
Like it's crazy.
Wow.
Like, because I also don't necessarily read bestseller books and I don't really care about the bestsellers, but I do subscribe to the New York Times. So every week I like to look at it.
Yeah.
And like this book is still there.
Yeah. So, and I'm definitely not saying that my perspective is the objective one because it's
not. Right, of course not. But
I didn't pick it up thinking about it that way, which is interesting.
When did you read it?
Same. I was when you and I started emailing about the show,
okay.
I had just started the audiobook.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
So, so same. You and I are kind of coming from it about
late. Like that's like the other thing. It's like with movies too. It's like if you went and saw Black Panther in the theater the day it came out, that's the best movie you ever saw. Mm-hmm. But if you went and saw Black Panther 2 weeks later, you're like, well, how come nobody's talking about Michael B. Jordan? You know? So like I feel like part of it is like, am I harder on this book because everyone else has told me how great it is,
right?
Or am I harder on this book because I have read 100,000 books about Mormon fundamentalists and like Charles Manson and I'm obsessed with Waco. And like, so for me, like on page 8 of this book, she talks about Randy Weaver and like Ruby Ridge. And I was like, oh my God, we're going full Ruby Ridge. I love this book. How come nobody told me it was about a cult? And then I was like, oh, nobody told me it's about a cult because it's not about a cult.
She really then kind of sidesteps it.
Yeah.
And doesn't get into that. I totally agree. And I'm literally coming from the same perspective where I like, I'm obsessed with that stuff. So I could have heard her talk about, I could have heard her describe their bunker or how much stuff they were making.
How many jars for Y2K? Like, I need to know.
Like, and oh my God, that was heartbreaking.
The
Y2K her story about the Y2K night.
And her dad, I read that because the start of the next chapter was her saying how her dad like never brought it up again. And I said to my husband, I was like, listen to this sentence about Y2K. Like
out of control.
That's the stuff. Like the super specific stuff in this book is what is like bonkers amazing.
Yes.
The stuff that is more generally like, and not that her abuse was general, but like it was so, it just felt like so by the book maybe.
Right.
And like that's probably part of it is because like all abusers and psychopaths are really the same. And like there isn't a wide playbook. It's like you do this, you do this, you do this.
Right.
But like the stuff about her experience as a child, and like that was the stuff that I was like, yo, this book is insane. And then the stuff that was like, Sean's a dick, I was like, yeah, Sean's a dick. We all know Sean's a dick. Stop going back.
And it was really like, I think this is where, especially when you're talking about memoir, where like an editorial, and I'm sure this was edited. And again, like we're talking about, it's a beautiful book, really.
Yeah.
But I was like, this is, the episodes that you're recounting are very specific and important to you, Tara Westover.
Mm-hmm.
To me as a reader, to understand your experience, you've already gotten me there.
Right.
I get it. I don't necessarily need to hear the next phase or like then she was talking about seeing all the girls in the mirror and the 16-year-old self coming. I mean, like all that stuff, I was like, I'm not really connecting with this so much.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And I was like, this is clearly something that you need to talk about in therapy for, you know, the rest of your life.
Right.
And I'm sure that it does dominate your journals, which she was really obviously relying a lot on her diaries throughout that she kept throughout her life in writing this book. But yeah, I could have read so much more about her dad proselytizing about Y2K and then being humiliated when the world didn't end.
Right.
And then the she didn't go into as much more of the significant brain damage that it seemingly almost everyone in her family suffered.
Well, that was something. Okay, so I wrote this down. I wrote down the strength and the resiliency of the human body. That's like the theme of this book.
Truly.
Like these people have all been majorly injured multiple times.
We're talking about a hugely concussed in a car crash.
Yes.
And
like the mother.
I can't even.
The fire with Luke's leg.
Yes.
The gasoline-soaked jeans that then were lit on fire by accident.
And doused in a like a trash can.
Tara.
It sounds crazy.
When the mom was like, what were you thinking? He's like in a trash can. I was like, honestly, Tara, like how did you get into Cambridge? Like,
oh my God.
It's like,
I mean, granted, she was 10, but I was like, whoa.
I mean,
not great.
Clearly, her ACT studying really helped her.
Yes.
But then Sean falling off like 20 feet in the air, hitting his head on the way down, then like coming to, then getting tackled to the ground by 3 men, hitting his head again,
and
then the motorcycle accident.
And then like something like 2 weeks later, like careening off the road in a huge motorcycle accident where his brain was leaking out of his skull.
Yeah. And then the dad in the fire.
The dad literally was standing next to a thing that exploded.
Like a blowtorch.
All
a fuel tank.
Over his body.
And then her
the description
leg.
Of his hands. Oh my God.
Her leg in the steel thing.
Oh my God.
Plus her getting the shit kicked out of her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just I sometimes have stomach aches.
Right? I was like, I cannot relate
to this. So this headache that I have right now, because I'm dehydrated, this is not the same. Like, I would like to be in a basement right now. But like the idea that the human body can handle so much. Nobody dies until the grandma dies at the end of like 10 years of cancer.
Right.
I'm like, are you, what are you, they're clearly doing something right.
You know what?
Which made me think, is the mom shit legit? Her,
right? Should we start investing in this?
Her, like, ointments.
Truly, something that we're all learning is that, like, spite and vitriol will keep you living.
Forever.
Forever?
Forever.
Why is Trump alive? The man, we've seen what he eats.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the only thing I can explain is that you something about the fires of, like, hate really sustain people.
This is why we have to keep hating books, because then we'll stay alive longer. We gotta have
something. You know, we gotta have something.
If you love every book, you'll die in a year.
Yeah. No.
But it's true that the dad,
it's like almost like and clearly from the dad's standpoint, it ends up being the explicit stated sort of purpose of his life, but we're getting there the whole time is railing against the medical establishment. And so the dad, I mean, those parts were hard to listen to. Mm-hmm. To the narrator describe the disfiguration that was done to this man's body and the enemas to keep him alive. I was like, I don't know if I love any man that much.
Right.
But he his heart stopped. I mean, he was burned so badly that he probably shouldn't have survived, especially since he wasn't in a hospital.
Right.
But he came back and he lived. And I was like, you know what? Part of it must have been because in his head he was like, if I'm, you know, it's like he thinks he's called by God.
Right.
That's compelling.
Right.
That's a reason to live. Oof.
Yeah. I mean, you also wonder, like, if he had gone to a hospital and, like, gone to a doctor, like, maybe he would have been fine in a week. Like, what do we know?
We don't know. Have no idea.
There's not like there were two of them and one went to the hospital and one didn't.
Right.
You know? And, like, I think my husband is a doctor. And so I have a lot of feelings and thoughts about people who are anti-medicine and science.
I used to be married to a doctor.
Yeah. Part of it is like there's a lot of things my husband and I disagree about when it comes to like things that aren't Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like not into doing it myself. Like I don't do Eastern medicine things, but I don't not think that you should.
Right.
And like we're in LA and like some of the mother stuff, I'm like, I don't think that like lavender is going to help you if you're massively concussed. But like if it works for you.
Right. Well, the power of the human mind is, right, placebo pills work, right?
Right.
We know that.
Right.
So, the Tara's mom in the book, it was also a fascinating section. Her mom sort of coming into her own as a
businesswoman.
Yeah, as a midwife. And,
yeah.
And then, but anyway, she clearly believes in this stuff. Tinctures, there's a tincture for everything. So, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the part of the book where I'm kind of like, there's a lot to fault Tara's family for, but the anti-medicine stuff, I'm like, I don't know. Like, he's alive. He shouldn't have been alive. All of them should have died from their things.
But then to me, the other thing was, I was like, I wish it was more, I wish, and she can't because these are real people and this isn't fiction. So, and also these people are still living, so we can't know. But I was like, Sean must have gotten worse. His brain was hugely damaged.
Right.
Her dad's brain had been, I mean, you know, can you imagine? He must have hit his head all the time doing all the stuff he did.
Right.
Her mom was in that car crash and she described the raccoon eyes that indicate lasting cognitive damage. And I was like, and then you have this group of people who have decided to deny reality, to dig to double and triple and quadruple down on their fundamentalist beliefs and their hatred of the system, and they only trust each other. You know, I'm just like, there's no way that cognitive decline isn't like hand in hand with this.
Of course. And so the other thing about like the medicine, especially the dad, she talks about like, oh, his lungs were charged so badly he couldn't breathe. But I'm like, how do you know that? You don't actually know what kind of internal damage he didn't go to a doctor. You didn't see his lungs.
Right.
Like you might hear that he's wheezing, but like none of you have any idea what's going on medically with any of these people. So that's also part of it. And like, which brings me to my next point about memory in this book and in memoirs in general, especially about people's childhood.
Mm.
I know she had a lot of journals, but she talks about things in her journals that are not accounted for, things she'd never thought about. And so I feel like in memoir, what's hard for me as someone who loves nonfiction is like nonfiction is documented and it's cited and it's sourced and there are facts. And in memoir, you're allowed to write whatever you want and say it's your experience or it's your memory. And it gets really interesting when they talk about Luke's accident and Sean's accident. Mm-hmm. And she makes, you know, the little notes, the footnotes. And then there's a part in the afterword where she talks about it even more. But like, we take her word for it because she is our author and we trust her. But there are so many parts in this book where she even says, I don't know if my memory is correct. Mm-hmm. And it makes it hard for me. So like, we actually don't know how bad the dad was burned. Like, we don't know if it was actually his brain coming out or mm-hmm. did she see just a lot of blood and it was gross and it was late at night. Like, right. we don't know the extent of a lot of what actually happened because we're taking the word of someone who is smart, mm-hmm. but smart people can misremember things. Like, smart people can get things wrong.
Especially when you're talking about events that were traumatic.
So traumatic. And she's 10. Like, mm-hmm. the Luke thing, I'm like, if you didn't know not to put his foot in the trash can, like, how am I supposed to believe you on this story?
Right. Right.
So I, like, and what is the obligation of the author for truth in their own memoir, and like, what is truth versus fact? Like, yeah. There's just so much here.
Man, I'm obsessed with these questions. I think it is part of why I love documentary. I love nonfiction. I love memoir because of these questions. Like, what is reality? What is history? What is the, you know, we were just talking about the history we can all agree on. And then of course you understand, like, right. who writes the history books? Like, right. None of this is true objectivity. We as right. human beings can very rarely know true objectivity. So, I mean, I love dancing in that space.
Right.
And as a writer, talking about like what makes something real. I do think in the book, you've pointed it out, her notes and her being like, listen, this was in my journal, but I was remembering this, blah, 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 almost made it worse. It like pointed it out.
Right.
In a way that I thought was interesting because she's an academic, so I could tell that she was kind of like, obviously she's very thorough mm-hmm. in her work in academia, and she's a historian. So that like was obvious kind of in how she was talking about this stuff. But I was like, this is your memoir. So I don't know if you need that, you know?
Right.
It says a memoir. And at the beginning of the book, you were really clear about these are just my collected memories.
Right.
So by taking such pains to point out your version of events may not be the true version of events, you're taking me out of the book and you're making me think about other parts of the book differently that I don't know is beneficial to me as a reader. Like,
I think I had the opposite.
Interesting.
I think I really appreciated it because I have read so many memoirs. There's a memoir that I particularly despise. It's called The Line Becomes a River by Francisco Cantu.
Okay.
He has a middle name. I can't remember what it is. And it's about – he is like – he's half Mexican, white presenting, goes, works border control, writes a memoir about it. And it's a memoir. It's not a nonfiction book. And I have a big problem with the book because I think that he went – he's a writer. Mm. He went to writing school, studied, and then like – or he – sorry. He went to school. Then he went and was like, I'm going to be a writer. Went and worked for Border Patrol. Then wrote this memoir.
To write about it.
That's what I think. He doesn't say that, but that is the impression that I get. Mm. And so for me, I'm like, this memoir is bullshit because you should have written a nonfiction book. If you want to be a journalist, if that's what you're trying to do, yeah. be undercover, then write that book, but cite it. In the book, he's like, I gave the man a shirt off my back. Like, I did this. I did that. I'm a hero. Then I met another Mexican. And there's like, there is no documentation for any of this. And so for me, I at least appreciated that she's like, this is what I wrote down, but that's not how I remember it anymore. Mm. Or like, this is my memory. And then being like, this is my memory. And apparently Luke says it was none of this, you know? And like, I appreciate that because I know that that is real and true to how things are remembered, mm-hmm. but it calls into question the whole idea of memoir for me and the whole idea of what is true in this family, mm-hmm. knowing that truth is so, can be, you know, bullied out of you, right?
Right.
Like Audrey.
Yeah.
Audrey is like, This happened. And then she's like, none of this happened. Like, Tara is the devil.
Yeah. Literally, Tara is the devil.
So yeah, like, so her memory and the memories that are put in this book, I'm interested in, but it didn't necessarily take me out of the book. It mm-hmm. just made me question more what I was reading, which I appreciated.
Yeah. And that's, it's interesting. Cause I mean, because I didn't not like it. I think you're right. I think what I was sort of grappling with was being presented mid-memoir with the fact that
this could all be wrong.
Yeah, this is like really tricky. And then as it goes on, she does then grapple with this whole like, what is reality? I mean, I think that is like a thing that she as a person is probably preoccupied with. And that's probably why she took these pains in this book to be like, literally the reason I don't talk to my family anymore is because we dispute reality. So I'm going to try my best, you know?
Right. And like, there's so much of their disputing of reality that led her to not believe her own reality, which is why I also wonder about some of her memories, if she has changed them at all because they were hard or uncomfortable or made her feel like it was easier to remember something nice that Sean had done because she didn't have to deal with all the baggage of all the bad things that also led to her like losing her whole family.
Right. I mean, how much has she blocked? How much? Right.
Or like chosen not to dive into because it's like, I already made him look bad. Like,
yeah,
that's not even a major thing. This was just a minor thing he did to me.
And I think what you and I are saying is like, is that we would have liked more of those specific moments.
Yeah.
And that stuff like that would have, because that's the stuff that I'll remember from this book. Mm-hmm. Those imagining her mom with those raccoon eyes not being able to come out of the basement for months. I mean, that's, and her dad sitting on the couch until 2 a.m. at Y2K. I mean, really, I really can't get over that story. The idea of her in that classroom raising her hand and being like, what's the Holocaust?
Right.
I mean, those are things that mean a lot to us as a reader. And they obviously were important to her in her life, but they're touchstones. You know, it's in some ways it's interesting for me to examine this as an author because I'm like, that did matter more, and that made her more real to me,
right,
as opposed to these sort of and then like all the stuff about her being in musicals. And I was like, well, are you still singing now? Like, what happened to that?
Right. I wanted to hear her voice. I was like, can you please sing on this book?
Right.
The audiobook just is a CD of her singing like her song.
I love it. It was just cut to a little like bit of it. Right. It would have been amazing.
Another thing that comes up in this book, which I guess is like another major theme of this book, is like the weaponization of religion against education. And I feel like that's not new. That did not start with the Westover family. And it's really prominent right now in America, like on different degrees. But like, we're dealing with a lot of, you know, that's fake news. Or like, I mean, global warming, like that's something that we're weaponizing Christianity against science.
Right.
You know, like that's like a really obvious one. And I just, it was really, just makes me sad.
Well, listen, and it sounds like you and I have similar interests. So I can't stop thinking about flat earthers and the fact that that's like taking off right now.
Right. Thanks, Kyrie Irving.
Oh my God. anti-vaxxing and the general distrust of science or whatever.
Yeah.
Just the fact, to me, I'm fascinated. I'm equal parts fascinated and terrified by the fact that conspiracy theory is so prevalent right now.
Yeah.
And it's so,
but
like,
was it
popular?
Always or not? Do you think it wasn't?
They've always been in the world.
Right.
But I think the issue is, previously, I'd have to be like, you know, something I've been thinking about is like, what if the world was flat? You know, we'd have to be like having wine over dinner like, and I'd have to sell you on it. And now I just have to go to Reddit and find the right subreddit and a bunch of people agree with me.
Right.
So, or I go to YouTube and without even thinking about it, I'm exposed to 25 videos in a row of other people who think the same thing. So it's just different how we are able to connect and have our beliefs reinforced. And I'm not even saying that this is inherently a bad thing because we see, of course, this also help educate people and spread a lot of the opposite, a lot of joy and understanding and empathy. But it is having this effect where fake news means everything's real because nothing is real.
Right,
like,
exactly.
That's where we are right now.
And like this book takes it a step further because it's the religion, it's God versus education. Right. It's either you're on the side of God or you're on the other side, whether it's medicine, whether it's school, whether it's the woman's role in the house, whether it's your brother beating the shit out of you. And like, I mean, we're seeing that now with the abortion debate. Either you believe that children are conceived at the moment of conception because Jesus, or you're a murderer.
Yeah, or you're literally a murderer. Yeah.
And like that's how these debates are being presented. And it's like, you can't, if you're on the side of being a murderer, like if you're pro-choice, then how can you have a conversation if the response is, well, I'm pro-choice. Well, then you're a murderer.
Yeah. Like, where do we go from here?
Where do we go? And like, how do you fight against, well, Jesus said this, you know? And like, we're getting to a place in this country where like Christianity has become so much part of our non-separation of church and state that like, there is no room for like, okay, you can believe that that's what Jesus said, but like, I'm Jewish.
Right.
Like, get out of my uterus.
Right.
Like, why is my uterus your problem then?
Absolutely. You know? It's really nuts. And it is alarming. And it, what was the name of that writer? She was a woman around our age who just tragically passed away.
She was like a Christian liberal.
Yes. And yeah. She was like,
I'll look her up. I know you're talking about.
Yeah. And
I talked about her on the Daily.
Yes. Yeah. And then there was a few write-ups in the New York Times that I'm sure we read the same stuff about it, but it was beautiful to read about her because of her campaign of in good faith with total love and spirit questioning her church. And it sounded like she was really gaining traction and was like encouraging this movement of Christians to discuss amongst themselves, what does it mean to be Christian now when our country is moving in progressive ways, at least sometimes. And I was doubly sad to hear about her loss because I think we need those voices now more than ever. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're like, it's interesting to think about in the context of this book, right? Her dad, it's almost like you didn't have time to question anything. She says over and over that her dad just lectured.
Right.
And would like, literally, if someone is standing there screaming at you for 2 hours, like at the end of that, why even talk at all? You're just so tired. You just like wore out.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We're kind of talking about the state of the world right now, which is hard to.
Yeah. The weaponization of religion against education or information or truth or whatever isn't new.
Mm-hmm.
And like it was going on when she was a kid in 1996 or 1990, like she was born in 86. So it was going on when she was a kid.
Right.
And it like to see now 30, 35 years later, like what that has become.
That's
like that
so,
the way, yeah. Randy Weaver mm-hmm. hero story has become this, you know.
Okay, this is maybe tying into what you're saying about why this book, why now, why is it so huge?
Right.
Two thoughts. The first one, what you just said is so interesting to me, and I think we are right now in a moment of grappling with like, okay, this is it. This is what Reaganism was.
Right.
Okay, now we can say, what was that experiment? How did it end up? With the economic situation we're in now, with whatever. And I'm not even putting a liberal or conservative spin on it. I'm just saying now we can see the results of what was put into effect 35, 40 years ago. And we need to decide if that worked for us or not.
Right.
And I agree with what you're saying. Like, so then the result is she was raised in like, what if we went off the grid and created this religion for ourselves or whatever? But I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. And I guess we care about this book because it's a story of this time. Like it's not actually like textbook from Reagan to Trump.
Right.
Like it's like this one woman's experience. And like she was six part of this book and like she didn't know. And like what did all of that mean?
Well, and this is the other thing I was thinking. Maybe it's so popular because in some ways this is a book about the eventual triumph of at least the pursuit of fact. Objectivity, learning, of caring about the world. Maybe we feel like there's hope.
Yeah.
Because she got out of that house because she chose her own mind.
Right.
Because she somehow has at least endeavored to unwire all of the deep-seated self-hate that her family planted in her.
Yeah.
So maybe there's some element of like, we will get through this time.
Mm-hmm.
And if we just try to stick true to ourselves and really be forceful with ourselves about what we believe in and what we care about, that like we can endure and outlive, you know, part of this, what makes the story so tragic is that she had no choice.
Right.
She never chose to go to school or not go to school.
Right.
She never chose, even to get her ID eventually, it was her mom. Right. She was so, kids are so vulnerable to their families and what their families do to them. And this was a really stark observation of that.
Yeah. I would be remiss not to talk about this. But one of the reasons I didn't read this book until now, until you suggested it, is that I just felt like I didn't really need another story of like a white girl who like triumphs. Mm-hmm. And like that there are so many stories in the world. And like we're just now getting to a place where like Korean authors are getting published a ton right now. Mm-hmm. And like, or where, you know, there's room for Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ibram Kendi and Saeed Jones, and, you know, and like, and right after Trump got elected, the book that like was at the top of all the lists was Hillbilly Elegies, which I've also chosen not to read. People are like, I can't believe I haven't read that. I'm like, it's a choice.
Yeah, same. Not reading it.
But like, there's something also, like, I would be curious to know the breakdown of people who have read this book based on, like, race, based on socioeconomic status, like...
political affiliation.
Exactly. Religious affiliation. Like, do you know how many people don't get a good education and don't go to Harvard and Cambridge who are really fucking smart?
Yeah.
Like, so there is something in this book, like, her inherent whiteness. Like, Mormon is, like, the one American religion. And, like, there are people who are not white who are Mormon. But that comes a lot from, like, the proselytizing and, like, the going places. Like, there's, like, tons of, like, Tongan Mormons.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, she is – when you find out this book is about a girl from Idaho, no one's like, oh – wonder if she's like from Honduras, really. Like, you know, like it's like there's something about rooting for this like white girl that is a big turnoff for me on this book. And like when it comes to educating and like talking about education, the fact that we're centering like this white girl, and like, yeah, they were poor, they lived on a mountain, but they chose that life for themselves. They weren't redlined for generations in Detroit. Like, they weren't immigrants from El Salvador who were separated from their families at the border. Like, while she comes from a lot of privilege in a lot of ways, she also comes from a lot of privilege. And it's a privilege that her story got written and published and people were obsessed with it. And Barack Obama read it, you know?
I super, super agree. And I think the phrase inherent whiteness is a really important one to apply to the story. And I think that's what tripped us all. That's like what started this conversation.
Right.
That's like tripped us both
back
up
at the end.
because that does feel like, I just think we have to consider that in talking about this book, because it's at the end of it, it was really striking to me. Like, it's white all the way through.
It's white on white.
It's white on white. And it's not, you know, this doesn't invalidate her experience, but what we're talking about is where should this fit within our cultural like conversation?
And like, why this book?
And why now? Because, I mean, she sort of gets herself out of Idaho, but then goes right into the bastion of BYU, Harvard, and Cambridge. And as we're saying, like, she sort of then whatever privilege that she didn't have, she then acquires.
Right.
Like, she was poor growing up. Now her family's rich, which is kind of wild. And I'm assuming that she is probably whatever. This book has spent 2 years on the list.
She made money
fine
from the book.
And she got scholarships.
Right.
And she, you know, so.
And once she was in those spaces, she was allowed to be in those spaces. Whereas if she was a, you know, Filipino, you know, queer man, let's say.
Right.
Like, she gets to Harvard and people are looking at him, you know, this person differently. Like, you don't just walk around BYU comfortably if you're a black woman, you know, like, she's blonde too. Like, she really just like fit in these worlds.
Right.
And so I think that like not acknowledging that, and like, I think that's part of the reason I didn't read this book. And it's not to say that like white stories about white women don't matter, but it is worth noting, like, Bill Gates is a champion of this book. Like, like, the fact that this book has been so successful, it has to do with her identity and, like, the identity politics of, like, whiteness and white womanness and white woman victimness.
Right. Can I throw out a theory that I'm interested to hear what you think about? This is making me think about the stories that, like you, I'm obsessed with, like, I mean, all the cult stuff.
Right.
A lot of fundamentalist stuff.
Right.
I really don't mean to be flippant about it because,
no, go ahead.
But like, sometimes it can, sometimes it feels like a lot of white nonsense, right?
Right. Totally.
Like a lot of the cults, especially, you know, when it talks about people dying and suffering at the hands of these things, that's another thing. But a lot of cults are like white people doing, at least on the outside, what looks like nonsense.
Right. Have you read a lot about Jonestown?
A decent amount.
So Jonestown is my favorite cult because it is not all white people. Right. Like he like targeted black people.
And he started as a really, he started doing really important civil rights work.
Yeah, in Indiana. And so that's one of the few cults. I mean, Jim Jones is one of my ultimate villains of the world to me. But that story gets really interesting because I always say, like, if I had been alive in the, it was in the Bay Area, you know, towards the end, like I probably would have been part of Jonestown because it like, civil rights and like we're doing this good stuff, and I probably would have been like, I don't really care about the Jesus part of it, but like there's all these black people and white people together doing stuff, and like we're building this culture and we're feeding the young and the poor and mm-hmm. we're helping elect politicians, and like we helped get Harvey Milk elected. Like, so mostly yes, I feel like mostly cults are like a lot, and there are cults that are all different, you know, there's like right. this crazy cult in Africa and they like set themselves on fire in an ark. Like 1,000 people died. It happened right before 9/11, which is why nobody talks about it. And because it was 1,000 black people, nobody cares. But there are. But the ones that have like footing are, I think it's because like the media can see itself in the white people too. Like it's like, I want to cover Randy Weaver because mm-hmm. like he just didn't want to pay his taxes, or like he just right. wanted to have his guns, and like, who cares?
Well, and that's so interesting. And I think you're right. I definitely think you're right. But I think also part – oh, God. I really am risking saying I don't want to – as a white person, sometimes those stories are more interesting or fun, quote unquote, to experience because it's white people destroying each other.
Sure.
Which is like – great.
Well, and we have so many versions of white people.
Right.
So it's like, it's okay because you know that a white cult leader doesn't speak for all white people.
Right.
Whereas if it was a Cambodian cult leader, you would be like, all Cambodian people are cult leaders, you know? So I right. feel like there is, like, it is more entertaining because we have been taught to differentiate white people right. from one another.
Yeah.
So in the same story, you can have a white hero and a white cult leader, and it's not confusing, and you're not like, this is about all white people. Like, no, it's about these crazy white people.
And I guess, and part of where I'm coming from too is like, just hearing you talk about this, what strikes me is like, I would love a book about why are minorities seem less likely to engage with culty stuff.
Because they have like other problems.
I know,
there's
right?
other shit going on.
There's some element of cultural significance, it feels like to me, right. of like, why is it less likely? You know, what was that called? The cult that was following Haley's...
Oh, yes.
The Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate.
There were a couple... Did you listen to that podcast? Mm-hmm, oh, mm-hmm. So good. But there
and
were,
that guy was in a cult.
Yeah, which was fascinating.
And he was a black guy.
And they were... hella racist to that yeah. family, even yeah. though they were in the cult. Yeah. And I was like, that is so unusual.
Right.
And it was fascinating to hear him talk about it because of that, because it's so unusual.
Right.
I don't know.
I also think, you know, this is like really anecdotal and probably not real, but I think also for like a lot of people of color, like there's a lot of pressure from your family and your society to like be twice as good and like not fuck up, and know that if you do fuck up, like if you're Muslim and you shoot up a public space, like you know that all Muslims have to answer for you now, mm-hmm. you know? So like, I wonder if that's also part of it. It's like, we're taught from a young age, like don't embarrass me, you know,
yeah,
like by
well,
your parents.
And I think that also reflects a type of parenting, right? That is
right,
like
exactly.
involved. And I mean, a lot of these young men that we're seeing getting radicalized right now, I'm like, well, where was your family?
Right.
You seem to be spending a lot of time on your computer.
Right.
I'm not trying to lay blame anywhere,
right.
but you know, of course these are complicated things, but it does feel like, yeah, right. you have less engaged parents, or like, I don't know. I come from a white family where sometimes we just don't talk about stuff.
Right.
And like, so you can see how things could ferment.
Right.
Or get distorted over time.
There's so many things. And there's also like, there's a expectation of like ownership and whiteness and like that you're entitled to a public space and like that you belong there and like nobody calls the police on you for a lemonade stand if you're two little white kids.
Right.
You know, like, so there's also, I think people of color have, especially people who are black and brown, like who present of color as opposed to people who pass. Mm-hmm. But like that there is an understanding that like this isn't your space or your country. And like we're hearing that a lot right now. But even before right now, like not a lot of black people are like out in public spaces in mixed company, as we say, who are acting a fool because they mm-hmm. know someone is going to threaten their freedom and their liberty in a way that a white person would be like, no, you don't get to do that. I belong in this space. I belong mm-hmm. at this library. I belong in this school. Yes, I can take my gun to my school because it's my school, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's just like, there's a lot of factors that play into why we see more. And then I also think like, I feel like we have to say something about this. We're like running out of time. But one of the things that comes up in this book is mental illness mm. and how there's a connection between like paranoia and bipolar and all that stuff and cult. Mm-hmm. And not to say that that is anything to do with race,
right.
but just I wanted to throw that out there too, because she talks about it in the book, comes up with her dad, comes up a lot with like with Waco, I'm blanking on his name.
What was that?
Branch Davidian, David Koresh.
Yeah.
Whew. Still
nice.
Got it.
Nice.
Still got my cult knowledge. But like that David Koresh was like, you know, and Jim Jones was like a drug addict and bipolar and manic and like all the things. And so this like paranoia that the dad has and that Sean has and like...
Yeah. I mean, she and Tara's not, nor does she present herself as a medical professional, but she basically says, my dad is manic depressive. And right. it onset when he was, you know, because he started having their seven kids when they were so young. And so they had four kids by the time he was 25.
Right.
She mentions in there that 25 yeah. is a typical age when it can sort of onset
right.
for men, and that she kind of traces his behavior and assumes that that's what happened because
right.
he became a lot more reclusive and a lot more intense.
Right. But like that we have language around that is not mental disorder, that is all these other things. Mm. And like we see that with these shooters, right? It's like, oh, like he was ill, but it's like, wait, no, like there are a lot of people who have mental illness who don't go on to do this stuff.
Right.
So like while he might be bipolar or whatever, paranoid, there's also like other stuff that feeds
what's, what are
into
the other
that.
Factors?
Like,
yeah.
Cause like I have plenty of friends who are bipolar, they're not violent
they're
people.
Not, yeah.
They're not cult leaders.
Yeah.
Like I know schizophrenic people, also not violent. Like it's usually self, they usually harm themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's what's really been, I mean, not to, I don't know how I got even onto school shooters, but like, or like mass shooters, but like that's the thing that's so reprehensible about the conversation about this is it's like stigmatizes people who have mental illness, who are hurting themselves. They're not hurting other people,
right.
but they're getting lumped in
right.
with like, these people whose names I won't mention because we shouldn't be yeah. giving their names airtime.
I know, but that is what makes this, listen, we're also talking about this a few days after there were two mass shootings within
yeah.
24 hours. So
right.
of course it's on our mind.
Right.
So that's the context for this conversation, but it was so offensive to see the Republican Party's line after that being like, we need to talk about mental illness. And it's
right.
like, yeah, we do need to talk about mental illness and how, and like, you know, caring for people in this country that are
right.
suffering from mental illness and have needs. But like that, how dare you
right.
say that that is the cause of this and not rampant radicalization,
right.
white nationalism.
Right.
And it was like, it was just so offensive.
So, and they're also the party that has like slashed mental health benefits like crazy.
Yeah. And education and all these things
that would
just
be
like,
helpful.
So I think what we're
back to the book,
but I think what we're saying a little bit, and tell me if you think this is a correct characterization, is like she sort of presents this as a – she presents herself as this other.
Right.
And somehow I think for both of us, it wasn't satisfying how she did or did not address her otherdom in the context of – other otherdoms?
Or like her other, her un-othering.
Yes.
Or whatever, like how she became an other. Because
yes.
she was part of this family and now she's not.
Right.
And we both wanted to see more of her journey of like othering herself.
And like, don't you think, I just can't believe that there wasn't an experience that she had with a person of color or an LGBTQ person where she had a conversation about like, oh yeah, sometimes I feel like
right.
I don't relate or I've got this other perspective. I mean, there
or
was
like,
just
how does this work? Or
right.
like,
there was none of that. And yeah. I think that's what we both are like walking away being like, oh, I think there's parts of her life that we would have been interested to know about. And I'm not sure why they weren't presented.
Right. And like, what things is she still grappling with?
Right.
Cause I feel like we hear that a lot with people who like a lot of times you hear this with women who have been sexually abused that like, they, like, especially if they're in a relationship that was abusive, that they're still dealing with like the ways they were groomed and the ways that they were abused and the ways that they internalized misogyny. Mm-hmm. And like, I appreciate that because it makes it clear that just because you're done being abused or you leave that relationship, that that thing still is with you, that mm-hmm. you're still affected by that. And mm-hmm. I feel like she doesn't do a good job of saying like, this is where I am in my journey.
Mm.
Like I am a work of I'm like, I'm a work in progress. I'm only 32 or 33. So like, this is where I am at the writing of this book.
That's such a good point because it was like a kind of a shock to then look at videos of her later and be like, oh my God, she's so young.
Yeah.
And she talks about phases of her life where she has these like depressive states
right.
or whatever. And I do think that though she's so rigorous about telling us this may be true, this won't be true, this is what someone else said, this is what I think. But she's not rigorous about contextualizing this story within her own life. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish that she had been clear of being like, just like what you said, like, I'm still on this journey, but here's what I think about it now versus then. She's sort of maybe even more of an authorial voice of like, as I write today, you know, because we heard her read parts of her diary or whatever.
Right.
But it wasn't her being like, you know, I still don't understand and I still whatever. I could have used a little more.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, we have to wrap up. We kind of went long today. I don't care. There's just so much to talk about in this
book. This was fascinating. It really was.
But the last thing I definitely want to do is title and cover.
Oh, man.
What do you think of the cover? What do you think of the title, Educated?
I think the cover is gorgeous.
I love this cover.
It is really
I didn't
beautiful.
See a lot of it like online, like seeing it and stuff. I couldn't see like the little birds. I couldn't see like the gradation of like the valley and the mountains and stuff. Like
whoever drew this.
So beautiful. I'll tell you who drew it.
Oh yeah.
Let's give a little shout out to Patrick Svensson.
Well done, Pat.
Pat.
You really nailed it.
Patty S. We love you.
Patty S. Well done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the colors are like right.
They're stunning. I mean, it's very like primary color type of thing, mm-hmm. but it obviously it's a pencil that if you look closer reveals a mountain. And she, so much of her book and her obvious longing for the environment in which she grew up is about this mountain. And so I think it was clearly also, I love when you, after you read a book and you look at the cover and you're like, oh, that artist read the book.
Right.
Like that's great. You know,
totally.
However, I don't know. I'm meh on the title.
The title's fine.
Yeah. I don't, I can't.
I might feel like, I mean, I think there already is like a book called like Anna Education, but like, I like that it's one word. I always like a one word title. I always think that's fun if you can make it work, but I don't think it was quite educating. Like, or like, I don't know, like get, like it should be more active.
Well, I also think both you and I were a little unprepared for what was in the book.
That's true.
So it wasn't.
I think we both thought it was going to be more about education.
Right.
Or like her education.
Yeah. Because like educated, and then all that you really know going in, or all that I really knew going in, was that she was quote unquote homeschooled. Truly, she had literally no education, and then went on to be at Cambridge and it's educated. So I thought it was going to be so much more centered on that.
Right.
But it's a lot about her life and family, actually. So I was like, we were not ready to hear all about the family because of the title, I think.
Right.
And I think, you know, so I don't have like an alternative suggestion.
I never have an alternative suggestion. I just critique. I don't ever provide options.
That's a really interesting question. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're all done today. Thank you guys so much for listening. Sarah, thank you so much for being here. This was an awesome conversation.
Man,
I'm so glad.
I know. I hope listeners enjoyed it. We really went off on some tangents, but.
Yeah, that's all we do around here is go off on tangents.
It was so fun. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And make sure you guys go check out Sarah's book, Tell Me Everything by Sarah Ennie. It's in the world. It's been in the world since February, so you can get it.
Yes.
And thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you in the stacks.
thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. And a huge thank you to Sarah Ennie for being our guest. Make sure to check out her book, Tell Me Everything, and listen to her podcast, The First Draft Podcast. Find everything we discussed on today's episode in the link in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, or check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegeerigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. And I will see you in the stacks.